I want to thank you for listening and for all your support as we at Death, Sex, and Money have made our move to Slate. Your stories, voice memos, and emails have meant so much to the team. As part of this transition, there's a new way to support our show financially at Slate, our new home, and you'll get something special in return. Subscribe to Slate Plus, and you'll not only support our work on Death, Sex, and Money, you'll get access to new benefits, including listening to us and all of the other great shows Slate makes, like Slow Burn and Decoder Ring, without any ads or sponsor breaks. To subscribe, just click Try Free at the top of the Death, Sex, and Money show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/DSM+ to get access wherever you listen. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
Hi, it's Anna. Earlier this week, I talked with actor Kevin Bacon on stage in New York in front of a live audience. And I wanted to share that conversation with you right away.
Thanks for having me. How's everybody doing?
He's in a new show on Amazon called I Love Dick. It's directed by Jill Soloway, who also created Transparent. And Kevin Bacon plays Dick, a sculptor and rancher in Marfa, Texas, who everyone in town wants to sleep with. The show I Love Dick is all about exploring the constraints of monogamy. In real life, Kevin has been married for nearly 30 years to actor Kira Sedgwick. So I wanted to know about that contrast and what it's been like for him to play a role at 58 years old that is most defined by sexual magnetism.
I can't really 100% act that. You know what I mean? It's like I don't really feel like I can act... You can't come into a room, in my opinion, sexy. You can come into a room wanting something. You can come into a room being desirous of another person. You can walk into a room, you know, hungry or angry or fearful or irritated. There's a lot of other things that you can kind of play, but sort of trying to play sexy is not something that really works. I mean, however, that being said, I think that the it's a story that needs to be told. So not just me, but everybody that's involved with it, whether it's camera, music, hair, makeup, wardrobe, is to try to create this, kind of object of desire.
So there's been much said about Jill Soloway's sets and how she creates these really intense communities. You know, on Transparent, for example, actors on that show have talked about how being on that show has made them think about gender in different ways and sexuality in different ways. Have you found working with Jill Soloway on I Love Dick, are you thinking about desire and monogamy in ways that you hadn't before?
No.
Okay.
No. No, I'm not. I mean, I love the experience, and I certainly had a fantastic, as an actor, it was a great place for me to go because, I've done so much work that I'm sort of at a point where I'm very, very practical about my work. You know what I mean? I do my homework. I want to know what the day is. I don't want to, you know, fuck around and waste time. And you know what I mean? I want to come in and do my thing. And I had to kind of let a lot of that go because it was a very, very fluid sort of process, not chaotic, but just kind of fluid. And my wife, who is often, gives me a lot of sage advice, said to me you know, you need to leave yourself open to the experiences. You know, when sometimes I would come home and I'd be like, oh my God, it was batshit today. I mean, I didn't know what the fuck was going on. And she's like, honey, you just need to like, leave. And
I did. It's Marfa, man. Feel
yeah,
it.
Exactly. Yeah. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And I really did. And I think I was kind of resistant of it. When it comes to my feelings about the things that you mentioned before,
monogamy and desire,
anything that has I live my life outside of my work to learn and to do and to experience these things. You know what I mean? I think you have to have some kind of separation where the biggest lessons that you're learning are from friends and family and not from colleagues necessarily. That's the way I do it, but
That's interesting because you have lived your whole life
on a set.
Yeah,
I know, it's true. I know, you're right. I mean, it's you're right about that, but I and yet I think that kind of ability to make my work, it's not as important. Let's put it that way. It's not as important. The biggest lessons that I've learned or the most intense experiences that I've had. I mean, somebody, you know, you hear someone say, you know, men, you know, whatever, winning this Oscar is the greatest experience of my life. And, you know, I feel bad for that person, honestly. You know, not that I haven't won an Oscar, so, you know, by the way, I don't mean to, like, jinx it, because, you know, let me decide, all right, you know. But, I mean, when I hear that sort of thing, I think to myself, really, okay, you had a kid and that wasn't as good, you know, I don't know, you know.
So I want to ask you about those most important parts of your life. You have been married almost 30 years now. Mm-hmm. When you got married, do you remember what you expected marriage would be, and has it been what you thought it would be?
Do I remember what I expected? Wow. You know, I don't know what we expected, honestly. I didn't have any kind of like big plan, I don't think, you know. I really didn't. I mean, I remember it being certainly frightening and important and, you know, in some ways, I remember it being like a big, big thing in my life, but it's not like I thought to myself, well, this is what it's going to be. And so has it been, I don't know, it's just been what it is. I don't even know how to answer that. It's just been us. It's been the two of us. It's a partnership that, you know, in this case, you know, works.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't, it's funny because, you know, I got to tell you, especially now that it's been so many years and, you know, when you add up those years that every year we've been married, more people say, how do you keep the marriage? Like when we were married 2 years, nobody said, how do you keep that marriage
going?
You know? But like every year, every time I do an interview, that becomes up more and more. And that, you know, I've literally gotten to the point where I say, that's a question that I just can't answer because, especially in print, it's going to be a soundbite, and it's so disrespectful to the marriage to turn it into, well, it's because of, you know, whatever. I used to have a quote that I use, which was keep the fights clean and the sex dirty. And I thought it was
a good
quote.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a good quote. I used it for probably 10 years,
yeah.
Right? And then it got to the point where people started going, now, I know you said keep the fights clean and the sex dirty, but I want the real answer. And I was like, you know what? Fuck you. That's what I got. I don't know. I don't know. I just feel like whenever I pick up something, an interview that I've done or even a, these days, you know, it's going to become a clip, you know, or a soundbite, you know. And I see what it is that I say. I go, oh, that's just awful. It's just, you know, I try not to answer, try to give a good answer to that, which clearly I'm not.
Well, it's, I mean, I hear you, like, to have been in your family and to have married and to have become a father, all while being quoted by, you know, tabloid press and celebrity press, like, of course you've learned to edit yourself over time about something that you're trying
sure.
to protect.
Yeah.
When you became a father, you were already super famous.
Mm-hmm.
Footloose had happened.
Mm-hmm.
You had married in 88. Your first son is born in 89. What do you remember about what you wanted from your career as you were becoming a father, having had the experience of the huge mega hit and your life transformed?
Oh, yeah,
by that?
It was really bad, actually. I mean, you know, it was a great kind of combination passage because I was I got married, we got pregnant on the honeymoon. We didn't know each other. I mean, we knew each other maybe, I don't know, 6 months or a year. I don't even know.
Yeah.
I'm not so good on the timeline, but we hadn't really, it was, everything happened really quickly. I think right around the same time my mother was diagnosed with cancer, I felt like from a career standpoint that it was kind of a real low. You know, the things that I thought were going to work just weren't working. It was a very, very difficult time for me. And that was exacerbated by the fact that as in love as I was and so thrilled and so excited about this beautiful wife and this beautiful pregnant woman and this child coming into my life, I was making a movie about underground worms. And, and when we were doing a movie, Tremors, it's called Tremors, and we were up in Lone Pine, California. Kira was 9 months pregnant. And we're out in the desert, very much like, it feels very much like Marfa in a lot of ways when I think about it, you know, landscape-wise, that sort of like sweeping high desert, you know, endless sunlight and cool at night and warm during the day. I mean, and we had this little house on a street in Marfa, Texas, and in the middle of the night, I would pick her up. I was a sleepwalker. And I would, you know, scream, "We have to get out of here. They're coming for us. They're coming, you know, monsters and the whole thing." And I would pick up my, she'd be like, "Honey, honey, it's okay." And I would literally try to walk her out into the street and get her out of the house. And she'd wake me up and then we'd go back to bed. And and really, like, was it about Tremors? Partly, but it was also kind of about just
existential,
a lot of anxiety.
Tremors. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, about what was going to happen, you know, in the future. So, you know, it was a, you know, interesting, confusing, but sort of fantastic passage, you know.
What did you find that, like, when you think of when that passage ended and you started to feel grounded again, what was it?
Still waiting. I don't know. Yeah, you know, I mean, I think, I suppose that, after that I went and she started working and we started working. And once our son Travis was born, you know, now you gotta just, you know, you gotta stop fucking around. I mean, you got a kid now, you gotta just, you know, really focus a lot on him and our lives and trying to provide, and she was ready to go out and work, and so we were doing a lot of traveling and a lot of living on the road with an infant and a dog and my wife and I, and we lived in city after city all over the country, packing everybody up and going. We were, you know, the thing about us is that we've had this like kind of super, you know, what people would call a stable sort of existence because we've been married for so long, and, you know, there's that. But we really are vagabonds, you know. We always have a suitcase packed, in a way. There's always a suitcase kind of sitting around somewhere because we know that we can't get too sort of stuck, and that means physically moving, but it also is like kind of like, you know, job to job to experience to experience. And I think that that's one of the things that we kind of continue to do. And at that point in our lives, when our kids were very, very little, we were still really, really deeply in that. And you could look at it and go, well, what are you chasing, man? You know, or, well, you know, what are you running from or whatever. But whatever we were running from it together.
Yeah, to have a teammate in that.
Exactly. Like, that's exactly right.
Powerful way to start a family.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that's how we're all moving through the world, yeah. Even if we don't move apartments.
Right.
Or, you know, life is coming at us in ways that we don't expect and don't always have stability.
Not sure I answered your question, but that was a...
Yeah, you did.
Okay.
So now your children are both performers.
They are, yeah.
So having had the experience you've had with Hollywood and seeing the sort of how it can affect your life, what do you tell them about how to protect the core of themselves as they start their careers?
Well, you know, one of the things that's funny about, but one of the things that I did imagine, not so much about marriage, but about parenthood, was that there would be those moments when I was going to tell them something, but so far they haven't really come up. I mean, I keep thinking, you know, in every movie that you see, there's like this, like, great thing is, I remember my dad saying to me, and it's like, I don't know. It just seems like it doesn't, I don't know that we have those kinds of like specific discussions. I feel like once in a while, now that they're in their 20s, there will be something where we can, you know, give some kind of advice. But it really has, to us, been more about leading by example and, you know, wanting them to take their own path and their own road and being supportive of the things that they are doing and discovering and, you know, just being less of a... We have a certain amount of rules about being honest and compassionate and a, you know, decent person. But, like, outside of that, you know, there's not a lot of, like, rules, you know what I mean? Also, being able to support yourself and make your own money, that's another kind of, you know, thing that we've tried to teach them.
How did you teach them that?
They kind of sort of got it by osmosis. I mean, I don't know, just didn't give them the credit cards or whatever. I don't know. Just they, you know, my son has been, they've both been working, you know, since they were, you know, pretty young, you know, trying to do their own thing. So, I'm not really sure. I'm not sure. That's another thing. I'm not exactly sure how I teach that.
Did you tell them our money is not your money after a certain point?
No, never told them that. You know, I don't think they ever felt like, you know, we were going to kick them out on the street or something like that. I think they also both have a very, very strong work ethic, whatever. Both of their parents have been working since they were teenagers and supporting themselves since they were teenagers. So, you know, if that's what both your parents have been doing, then maybe that's what you're going to do, you know. My daughter is an actress now, but for many years was really not pursuing it. And even though I cast her as a young girl in a movie that I directed, we didn't really think that she was going to do that. And when she finally came to us and left school and said, this is what I want to do, I said, what happened to... you don't want to do that. What happened to you saying that you felt that this was not something that you were interested in? She said, I said that because I thought that's what you wanted to hear. And I realized at that moment that for whatever reason, we had not really supported the idea of acting as a career.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, it's almost like... you know, there's an element of it that Kira and I, as incredible as these careers have been for us, and we have so much gratitude to be able to work together. I mean, I don't want to put words in her mouth, but it's a lifetime of being told no, right? You know, you most of what happens to you as an actor is you audition for things and you don't get them. You know, mostly it's people saying you're not this, you're not tall enough, you're not old enough, you're too young, you're too short, you're too fat, you're too thin, you're, you know, whatever, you're not right. I mean, just think about that as a statement. You know, he's not right. You know, he's just not right for this. You know, she's just not right. It's a weird kind of like thing to want to toss your child into that, you know, lion pit. So I think that while we, as I said, have been always, you know, supportive of what they wanted to do, somehow she got the message that we were saying that. Now that she's doing it and enjoying it and working extremely hard at it, it's really nice to be able to actually share a little bit of experience.
Coming up, I ask Kevin Bacon what it's been like to be publicly recognizable for his entire adult life, and about the moment when he had fame, but not a lot of financial security. I want to ask you about money.
Sure. You need some?
Always. Yes, please. This episode is brought to you by Fail Better, David Duchovny's new podcast with Lemonada Media. On Fail Better, David, who has experienced both low and high-profile failures throughout his life, explores the vast world of failure, how it holds us back, propels us forward, and ultimately shapes our lives. Each week, he will chat with guests like Ben Stiller, Bette Midler, and more about how our perceived failures have actually been our biggest catalysts for growth, revelation, and even healing. Through these conversations, he hopes listeners can learn how to embrace the opportunity of failure and fail better together. Fail Better is out now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
This podcast is sponsored by Cloud Optimizer.
As a business owner or IT manager, are your cloud investment costs going up and you don't know why? It's time for Cloud Optimizer. As you migrate your business to the cloud, what you're spending and why you're spending it can get a little hazy. But Cloud Optimizer clears up the mystery and puts the cloud to work for you. Cloud Optimizer starts by analyzing usage patterns, right-sizing resources, leveraging discounts you may not be aware of, implementing automation, and much more. And by reducing unnecessary expenses and maximizing performance, Cloud Optimizer guarantees you a savings of 5 times what you spend for their service. As you utilize cloud-based services more and more, you don't have to lose sight or control of your spend. You can stay agile, streamline your costs, and optimize your performance, plus save significant money with Cloud Optimizer.
Make the cloud work for you with Cloud Optimizer. Get a free assessment and find out how much you can save by going to cloudoptimizer.com. Go to cloudoptimizer.com for your free assessment. That's cloudoptimizer.com.
We have had a lot of exciting new things to share with you about the show recently, but this might be some of our biggest news yet. Death, Sex, and Money is officially going to be live in New York City at the Tribeca Festival on June 11th. And I want to personally invite you to the live taping we'll be doing with the legendary journalist Kara Swisher. If you know Kara's work, you know her ability to get people to tell her things is unmatched. And she does it in her signature, hard-charging way. She's not afraid of things getting a little combustible. I have a slightly different interview style, so we're going to talk about that and play around with that in experimental ways that I think will make this a special show unlike any of our other live shows up to this point. And it's not often that I get to do a live Death, Sex, and Money show in New York, so I really hope to see you there. Whether you're in the city, on the East Coast, or just been looking for a reason to visit New York City, come on June 11th for this show. You can get tickets now at tribecafilm.com/deathsexmoney. We are so excited to see you there. This is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC. I'm Anna Sale. Kevin Bacon and his wife, Kira Sedgwick, were clients of investor Bernie Madoff, and they lost a lot of savings when that Ponzi scheme collapsed in 2009, though they've never said precisely how much. I asked Kevin about the day that he learned that his seemingly brilliant money manager was, in fact, a fraud.
I've been robbed a bunch of times since I was a little kid. You know, I used to get beaten up and my lunch money stolen. I was robbed at gunpoint on the Upper West Side and in the 80s, you know. So somebody comes either into your pockets or into your house and takes something from you, it leaves you with a sick kind of feeling. However, I think that you have to live your life trying to avoid bitterness, so, because that'll kill you, you know. I'm sure it's killing him, you know. So, you know, I try to just move on.
Do you think about money differently, having gone through that?
You know, I think that it, when you're an actor or any kind of a sort of creative person, you often you feel like that's not what you should be focused on. Now, granted, we all have a different relationship with money, and it is a very, very complex thing. It's just as complex as death and sex.
Mm-hmm.
and so I don't want to make generalizations about actors and artists in general, but oftentimes we put that off into a place where somebody else is going to have to worry about it because we're doing something that is above and beyond that and loftier than that. And I think that probably to a certain extent, I was kind of part of that. I've never really been very, very good at understanding money. And I it took me a long time to figure out how to even balance a checkbook. My parents were not very good at teaching us any kind of lessons about money. They just weren't. We didn't have a lot of money, but we never felt like we were going to be going hungry. You know, we all went to public schools, but if you really needed something, there was some money there for it. You know, it was a weird kind of message. It was never really like, here are the ins and outs of it. So if anything, it taught me that, yeah, you got a lot on your plate. You're going around, you're doing parts, you're doing this, you're doing that, you're, you know, doing interviews, and you're busy, and you're trying to raise your family, and let's put all these things in order. Along with that, you should have a little bit of an idea of what's going on with your money, you know, and in that case, I think we just kind of, like many people, just sort of looked the other way and went, that's over there. It's working great. Look at all that interest coming in. I'm sure it's fine. I'm not going to kind of keep an eye on it. And let me also say that when the whole thing shook down, we did okay.
You were like 49 when that happened. You're turning 50. You're just. It's interesting to me that you're.
I hate the nines. I've always said that I just don't like nines, and I'm about to have a nine next year. So I hope it's not a bad year because so far the nines have not been good.
The nines have not been good. I mean, for that to happen when you're 40, did you make different choices professionally because of that?
No, I don't think so. I'll tell you, actually. Again, I'm not so good with the timeline, but I think The Cure was on the closer at that time. And that was really, really, really helpful because that show, if she hadn't walked away, there's still a spinoff that's happening. I think it would still be on the air. And I think at one point she was, you know, the highest paid woman on television. So, you know,
shout out to Kira.
Yeah, right on.
Yeah.
I mean, let's not feel too bad for the Bacons. I'm not trying to weave a sad tale of, you know, I mean, I think that you, again, this is that thing, you know, you gotta look at what's good in your life. You know, you gotta look at what the positives are. Well, what are you going to do? What am I going to do? Trying to, you know, find the guy and say, you know, you took my money. I'm punching him in the face. I mean, you know, what am I going to do?
And have you let go of the bitterness?
Yes.
You're still trying. You have.
I have no bitterness about that at all. None.
Because you've been recognizable, basically, since you arrived in New York City, your career took off very quickly. You became famous. Is there a place, can you feel relaxed in public anywhere?
Earl Hexton public. Well, you know what it is? I don't know exactly what relaxed is exactly. Well, I mean, I know what relaxed is at home, but relaxed in public. When I go out of the house, once I walk out on the other side of that threshold, I'm bobbing and weaving a little bit. I am, always.
And
although I would say that when it comes to celebrity-friendly places, I think most people would be surprised to hear this, but New York is the most celebrity-friendly place in the world, as long as you stay out of Midtown. And now I don't go to Soho either.
But, thank you for coming down.
Basically, what I'm saying is that New Yorkers, if you're in a place where there are mostly New Yorkers, they're probably going to give you your space. They may say, "Hey, Kev, your last movie not too fucking good," but they're not going to. It's not going to be that same thing. It's not going to be selfies and and all that.
We often end our interviews on death, sex, and money with questions about one about death, one about sex, one about money.
Okay.
So on death, has there been someone you've lost in your life that has left you with regrets? A death that you think that you wish something else would have happened?
Regrets. Yeah, there is. Actually, I had a really good friend who, he just couldn't keep him off of couldn't keep the monkey off his back. And I wish that that would have gone a different direction.
On sex, you're 58, almost 59.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think about sex in your 50s differently than you did in your 40s?
Differently than I did in my 40s. God, that seems like just yesterday, my 40s. I don't know if I think about it differently. I guess I feel like... I feel like it's become, in some ways, even more important to me right now. I almost feel like I'm... trying to cram as much of it in before it's over for good. Does that sound weird? I don't know. That's kind of like.
That's what I Love Dick is picking up.
I guess. I mean, because I think that, you know, at a certain age, as a man, you know, you're going to start looking down. I'm not I'm not a fatalist kind of person, but obviously, you know, you start looking at a lack of power, you know, at some point, you know, down the road. And for whatever reason, at this point, approaching 60, I'm fully committed.
And on money, do you expect to earn more money this year than you did last year?
Oh, wow. I don't know about that. 2017 as opposed to... Well, I got to see if Dick gets picked up. I don't know. Yeah, you know, people talk about... net worth, and I think a lot of people really like to see a number grow on a page, and I don't care about that. You know, I want whatever the money is going to afford in terms of like my family and my you know, a nice place to live and being able to travel in a way that we want, being able to you know, give it away or do good things with it, you know what I mean? But to actually see a number on a page is something that's never really been interesting to me. I will tell you one more thing about money, and that is that because I worked and really started out so much as a waiter and kind of like hand to mouth, I keep a lot of cash on me.
Mm-hmm.
So probably shouldn't say this. How much cash do I have? I probably don't even have that much right now.
Okay, let's see.
I probably got
some bills.
I probably have This is actually light. Like,
really?
Yeah.
And you just keep it in your pocket folded up?
Yeah.
No wallet?
Mm-mm. No. I just, for some reason, I don't know. It's just a weird thing. Like, I don't leave the house without... And I've often said it's because just in case of the zombie apocalypse, and I'm thinking to myself, how do I buy myself off the island of Manhattan? I just like literally have like the thing. You go down to the Hudson River, and there's one guy, and they're like throwing everybody away, and he's got one little blow up raft, and I'm like, hey, buddy. And he's like, I don't need your cash. You're Kevin Bacon. Come on.
That's Kevin Bacon. His new show, I Love Dick, is out now on Amazon. You can see video of my entire interview with Kevin Bacon on our Facebook page, including the audience Q&A that followed. Death, Sex, and Money is a listener-supported production of WNYC Studios in New York. I'm based at the Center for Investigative Reporting in Emeryville, California. Our team includes Katie Bishop, Emily Botine, and Andrew Dunn. Thanks to Phoebe Robinson, Destry Sibley, Chase Colpon, and Jennifer Sindro and the entire team at the Green Space at WNYC for their help on this episode. The Reverend John DeLore and Steve Lewis wrote our theme music. I'm on Twitter at Anna Sale. The show is at Death Sex Money. Subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Go to deathsexmoney.org/newsletter. Our emails are really good. And we are still collecting your student loan stories for an upcoming episode. Email us or send a voice memo to deathsexmoney@wnyc.org. We have heard from a lot of you about how your education debt is shaping your life decisions, and that many people in your life, especially your work colleagues, have no idea how much you owe. But I can tell you, student debt is on a lot of people's minds. In fact, someone in the audience even asked Kevin Bacon about his student loans.
Did you take out student loans? And if so, when did you finally pay them off?
I didn't go to college. Yeah.
That's a way to avoid student loans.
Yeah.
I'm Anna Sale, and this is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC.